The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, good morning, everyone. That's a rousing response. Let me say it again. Good morning, everyone. That's an even more rousing response. A lot of enthusiasm for open government, to be sure. On behalf of the American University Washington College of Law and its program on law and government and its new collaboration on government secrecy, I want to welcome everyone this morning to this Openness in Government event. It's good to see so many of you here today and so many familiar faces as well at what is the first program to focus on the 2007 amendments to the FOIA, which took effect just 16 days ago today. This is a founders celebration event, which is something significant at the law school here, where we celebrate the founding of the law school back in the very end of the 19th century. And also today we're celebrating the culmination of a long process, sometimes a difficult process, of amending the Freedom of Information Act. And I know everyone here is interested in that. And what I'm going to try to do this morning is first tell you about our agenda. You'll see we're going to have three panels. I'll speak for a while, then we'll roll immediately into our first panel. Then we'll take a break, and then we'll have a second panel and a third panel. And I also want to mention the handouts, because what we've tried to do as befits an academic institution, is go through and provide a very good resource document for everyone to analyze, to understand and to analyze and perhaps even question the content of the 2007 FOIA amendments. What you'll see on that first page of that resource document is a breakdown of the bill by title and section, the bill itself, and then there is some bullets regarding miscellaneous and effective date provisions. We've broken it down into 10 amendment subject areas, and then we have an outline of the elements there. And at the very end, we have some questions, some initial questions that can start the process of analyzing, again, the content of the amendments, the implementation, the impact of them, and how things will be going now in the year 2008. Questions are good, I think, and we're going to be encouraging questions during this program because that makes for a good dialogue, and we hope that that's the first of many dialogues in the future. That's a big part of what this collaboration on government secrecy is about. That's something that we started here at the law school just this past academic semester. We had our first program on International Right to Know Day on September 28th. This is a second program, and we're going to be having a third program the first day of Sunshine Week on March 17th. The way it works this year with the calendar is that James Madison's birthday is on a Sunday, so the Freedom Forum at the new museum location is going to be splitting the weekend with us, so to speak. They're going to be having their program on Friday, March 14th, and we're going to be holding one here, an all-day program on Monday, March 17th. So to an extent, this might be a continuation process where we start the process of considering these amendments and have an opportunity to continue that dialogue on March 17th. I'd like to make some overarching points, again from an academic perspective, just to frame the nature of the 2007 amendments first. First, these are amendments that were almost perfectly within the regular 10-year cycle. The FOIA stems from the Administrative Procedure Act, 1946. Legislative hearings started about late 55, 56. It was enacted in 66, amended arguably 2 years early in 74 due to Watergate, then amended in 86, amended in 1996. And I think there's a good basis for suggesting that these amendments might have been in the year 2006, but for the fact that they were perhaps delayed by Executive Order 13392 that was issued by the administration in December of 2005. This is the first time in many, many decades that FOIA amendments are not comprehensive. And by that I mean to say there's virtually nothing for agencies in here. These are virtually entirely requester-oriented. One could say that even the OPM provision that works for possibly enhancing government employee status, the employees who have processed FOIA requests, that too is requester-oriented. The amendments are entirely procedural. There's nothing substantive here, nothing about any exemption whatsoever. Now, the closest that they came was that there was a provision in there regarding Exemption 3 that would have amended Exemption 3 and tightened up the standards somewhat, but that provision in Section 8 of S-849, before it then evolved into S-2488, that provision was dropped. Frankly, due to an error, I think, in the drafting process and some misunderstanding about that, and I already see half a dozen people over here nodding their heads in agreement, they well understand that process and how that went. Now, these might not be the last amendments in the near future. It is possible, perhaps, and this is something that we might get into today, that they will break the mold of the 10-year cycle. We certainly have that Section 8 Exemption 3 provision as a kernel for possible new legislative enactment, and there might well be a consideration right away beginning this year or next year in Congress where it's something that does not require another 10-year wait. That's speculation, of course, but I'm throwing that out as something that's worth thinking about. These amendments place a lot of new obligations on agencies, to be sure, some of them that are costly in some respects, and one could think of them in sort of a loose way, perhaps, as creating some unfunded mandates. You might hear that phrase from time to time, especially with respect to one agency in particular. There are also, in conclusion, or an overall summary, there is some variation on effective dates. There's some ambiguities, or are some ambiguities in here, perhaps even a major unexpected ambiguity or two, and there's much to be worked out as a matter of policy and case law. So what I'm going to try to do very briefly after those introductory overarching remarks is just work from the handout that we have, those five pages there, and hit very quickly as I can the high points to set the stage for the rest of our program this morning. As I mentioned, we've got the sections of the bill right there by subject matter. And on the miscellaneous and effective date provisions, it's worth mentioning that there are four different effective date provisions. Some things explicitly take place immediately upon enactment, some with a one-year delay, and then there's silence in other respects. One miscellaneous provision has to do with the funding of attorney's fees. Another one has to do with that Office of Personnel Management assessment of FOIA employee employment status, if you will, in a report that has to be filed 1 year from now. Then there are some findings there at the very beginning that are uncodified. One finding is regarding a presumption of openness. You'll see that word in the findings three times. And there's also been a question of whether that finding or in any respect overrules the Ashcroft Memorandum, and there's been uncertainty about that, and I think it's pretty clear now that that's not the case. There is also a finding there regarding further changes. Congress is indicating that it's going to be looking at the implementation of the 2007 FOIA amendments and considering whether further changes are needed in the bill, and that ties into what I said a moment ago. By the way, you'll see the bill and the law there in two forms in your handout package. We have the bill itself as passed, and we also have what's called a Ramsayer version of the statute in codification form, named after a congressman almost 100 years ago who decided it would be a good idea, a congressman named Ramsayer. If you could see in italics where language is new and interlineation strike out where it's been changed, it's no longer there. And that Ramsayer version at the very end of your handout is the first such codification version of the law that's been created anywhere, and that's something that's on our CGS website, and we've printed that out here today. We've had that up since Friday afternoon, and we've printed it out for your reference as well. Now, what I've done with the 10 amendment subject areas is, come up with 10 of them and listing them roughly in order that I think are of importance. The first five, I'd say, are more important than the 6 through 10. And people might disagree as to which provisions are more important or will have a greater impact, but this is just an opening bid, if you will, to rank them in that way or to discuss them in that relative order. And what I'll do in the next few minutes is just cover the high points on the outline that we have about those 10 parts of the bill. The first thing to note with respect to the Office of Government Information Services is that it's a new office established at the National Archives and Records Administration. Excuse me. And that provision takes effect immediately. So as of 16 days ago, NARA's had an obligation to have that office there and to offer certain services and undertake certain functions. There are five major functions there of that office. First three are to review agencies' policies and procedures, review FOIA compliance government-wide, and then make recommendations of policy changes. I think it's fair to say the third one is sort of a culmination of the first two. Then that office also offers mediation services, and fifth, as a matter of administrative discretion, might issue advisory opinions. It's not entirely clear whether those advisory opinions would be only in connection with mediation or it might be even things beyond mediation that office learns about as part of its review process. There's no mention there of the functions that have been performed historically by the Department of Justice. In my old office, the Office of Information and Privacy, the Justice Department did object to this provision in the House side in earlier stages of the process, but it went forward nevertheless. And there's one thing that's maybe worth mentioning, and that is originally this provision was to be effective 1 year after enactment. In other words, there would be a one-year implementation period, but that somehow was changed in the process, and it became effective immediately. Second area is the prohibition on charging fees. This is something that works as a penalty on agencies that breach a time limit, any time limit, in the words of the statute. If you breach a deadline and the requester owes or has made a request for which search fees are applicable, copying fees are applicable, every requester, including commercial requesters, gets a waiver in effect of the search fee. There's no search fee whatsoever. And then for the favored category requesters under the 1986 amendments, which are representatives of the news media, educational institutions, such as where you are here today, and non-commercial scientific institutions, there's no copying fee. Now, the only exceptions to that is where the unusual circumstances or exceptional circumstances of the Act apply. The former is the provision that agencies have always used for a long time to invoke an additional 10 working days to respond to requests, and the second is the one that courts use in order to get Open America stays, grant Open America stays in court. And I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see how that provision is implemented. That's something where there's a lot of ambiguity, a lot of room, and perhaps some considerable difference of perspective or opinion on that. The third is the contractor provision. And there's some ambiguity or perhaps uncertainty here, too. The law now says that the FOIA applies to, quote, information maintained for an agency by an entity under government contract for the purposes of records management. Now, this language is subject to interpretation. The Senate report suggests a limited, narrow interpretation, but it could be interpreted more broadly. And a concrete example of that is that if you have an agency function that is commercial in nature and that goes through what's called a circular A76 outsourcing competition process, and some outside contractor wins that competition, basically takes that function away from the agency, why wouldn't the records pertaining to that function be covered by this provision, just as those same records would have been covered by the FOIA had the agency won the competition and had the records remained within the agency? There's the potential for records basically being removed functionally from an agency beyond the scope of the FOIA, and there's a large question as to whether this provision will address that adequately. There's another large question regarding the mechanics of the operation of this provision. Let's imagine that we're dealing with records that are maintained by a contractor, and everyone agrees, there's no question whatsoever, that they are covered by this new provision. Well, what does a FOIA requester do? Does it make a request to the contractor? Does it make a FOIA request to the agency for whom the contractor works? Does it have to do both? Do agencies have to have regulations that describe the location of every such contractor so that requesters know what is there and how to go about that process? If there's judicial review, someone sues because there's a disagreement about what happens on that request, is the contractor also a party in interest involved there? There are a lot of questions regarding the mechanics of the operation of that are yet to be answered. Fourth, there's the new attorney fee standard. And this is something that deals with the language of the Act that talks about how a requester, if successful, can get attorney's fees at the end of litigation. The language in the statute is substantially prevailed. In other words, the requester will get attorney's fees and costs if the requester substantially prevailed, otherwise not. Well, this provision basically defines substantially prevailed for the first time. And it says that a requester does substantially prevail if the requester gets certain relief from the court. Now, the primary aim of this provision is to overrule the Buchanan rule, the so-called Buchanan rule, which said that requesters had to get specific court orders in order to qualify. But this provision goes beyond that, very arguably, in the sense that it defines for the first time substantially prevailed in a way that handles the Buchanan situation, to be sure, but also perhaps calls into question the continued viability of all of the case law that interpreted the word substantially prevailed prior to that, specifically the case law that established an additional entitlement criterion beyond the eligibility criterion. And it's entirely possible that there's going to have to be no small amount of litigation. Whether attorney's fees will be granted at the end of that, I'm not sure, but no small amount of litigation over this very provision. And one of the things that we might be mentioning here today is a decision that was issued just yesterday in a case brought by the National Security Archive versus the Department of Defense that goes back to 1986, in which Magistrate Judge John Fascioli yesterday ruled against the requester and said, no, I don't think I'm going to award fees. Well, if this provision is effective as of December 31st, 2007, and it establishes that standard, perhaps to the exclusion of others, perhaps that case will be one of the first test cases for both the effectiveness and the overriding effect of this provision. That's something that we may talk about a little bit later this morning. Fifth item is news media definition. The fact that the 87 amendments has, for the first time in statutory form, a definition of news media and a definition of news. Now, most of this definition incorporates the 1987 OMB fee guidelines. Tracks the language almost word for word, with a little variation. Most of the remainder of it takes language from the 1989 National Security Archive decision that, ironically, was the very same case in which Magistrate Judge Fasciola issued that no attorney's fees decision yesterday afternoon. This language does not speak about at all does not explicitly address a hot new category of requester, specifically bloggers. No mention of bloggers on the face of the statute. No mention of bloggers in the Senate report, which is probably the only authoritative report that applies to the amendments for purposes of legislative history for interpreting the provisions of law. All that is said in floor statements is that bloggers are not automatically excluded. So we do seem to have some open question about bloggers, at least to the extent to which some versus all bloggers are included in this definition. And it's possible that you're going to see a very quick, well, a relatively quick administrative development if the federal government decides to now go through a new regulatory process, either at agencies individually or through OMB more generally or both, that puts gloss on top of this statutory language. That process, however, will be under the Administrative Procedure Act. There will be an opportunity for notice and comment, so it won't be something that comes out just overnight and tries to govern the standard that way. Okay, now we go to five, what I would say is less significant portions of the 2007 amendments. The first is tracking of requests by phone or internet, and agencies are obligated now to have one or the other, call it a hotline in either event, although most of us think of hotline as a telephone hotline. They're required to give requesters a tracking number, and this is for requests that are not responded within 10 days, which are practically all requests, a tracking number, a request receipt date, and also, quote, an estimated date on which the agency will complete action on the request. That latter thing is something new under the sun, and that's going to cause no small amount of consternation and trigger no small amount of activity within agencies. Now, the Justice Department, I've heard, my old agency, has somewhat inexplicably suggested that in this section there's really nothing new. It's nothing more than what agencies already do under existing practice in implementation of Executive Order 13392. I don't know about that. I think this last provision in particular is certainly something that is new under the sun. Now, I will have to say, though, that agencies will have some time to sort this out because this is one provision that does not kick in immediately. There is a one-year delay on this. Next category is reports. We have all sorts of reports here. Big reports are the agency annual FOIA reports, and there are a lot of new extensive changes to that. Agencies have new obligations, new categories, using average days in addition to median days, which, frankly, we in the Justice Department thought made sense in 1996, but Congress didn't enact it that way. So now we have both average days and median days, and data on administrative appeals, and data broken down by components. You're going to be seeing in the 2008 fiscal year annual report, which is due February 1, 2009, a lot of new information broken down in new ways. As well, agents, requesters will have the opportunity to get the underlying statistical data used by those reports, used for those reports. That's going to be very interesting, I think, for statistical analysis for people trying to do research on agency performance under the Act. Again, speaking from an academic perspective, a little but rather significant provision. Now, this part of the bill, part of the law, oddly uses, and I want to flag this for you, the word days, and then sometimes later it uses quote unquote business days. Now, we're used to speaking of the deadlines under the FOIA as 20 days, meaning 20 working days or business days. But there is one provision in the Act for expedited processing which talks about 10 days, that very quick, rigorous response deadline that an agency has, where day there means calendar days. So there might possibly be some ambiguity here because Congress has now used days, business days, in different ways. There's going to be explicit obligation on GAO to undertake a report, to undertake audits and issue more reports on the FOIA. That's right in a new subsection I of the Act. There's a bolstering of the arbitrary and capricious standard of the Act, which requires a report from the AG to the Office of Special Counsel, and then a or pardon me, from the AG to Congress that it has referred something to the Office of Special Counsel, Justice has, under subsection A4F, the sanction provision, and then a report to Congress by the Office of Special Counsel. The bottom line is that there's new reporting to Congress regarding cases in which sanctions are issued, and that can revivify and bolster and strengthen that sanction provision of the Act. And finally, I've alluded to earlier the fact that OPM is going to have an obligation, does have an obligation to provide, produce a report on FOIA officer, FOIA employee performance standards, on whether there should be a new grade structure, basically a new personnel system for formalization of that aspect of federal workforce performance. And also the question is whether there's going to be a need for further awareness training, quote unquote, government-wide, regarding both the FOIA and, a little wrinkle here, the Privacy Act of 74. Both of those statutes are referenced there. It's easy to miss, and it's possible for those of you who care about the Privacy Act that you might see OMB, what's the best phrase here, OMB nudged, if not an even stronger phrase, to do more with respect to Privacy Act training government-wide, because that responsibility is over there. Next category is executive order codification, and basically what the law does is it takes a number of the key elements of the executive order that's been in effect now for more than 2 years, such as the chief FOIA officer, FOIA public liaison, a FOIA service center, although in the executive order it's called a FOIA requester service center, so there's just a slight word difference there, and require that as a matter of law. Oddly, there's one provision here regarding FOIA liaisons that is delayed for 1 year, even though elsewhere in the bill there are comparable obligations that take effect immediately. So there's just some sort of little glitch there in the statute with respect to effective date. It makes only a slight difference, I think, because it has to do with the resolution of disputes between the requester and the agency. So there's a slight difference in the language. One takes effect immediately and one takes effect a year down the road. Now, time limit procedures, another significant area. What the law does is basically make very clear, it codifies what is general existing agency practice, that the time limits, 20 working days to start, begin to run from the date that the request is received by the agency. And so long as it's received by an appropriate part of the agency, in other words, part of the agency where the agency says under its regs, this is where you send FOIA requests. It should be also in the agency's FOIA reference guide as well. That's nothing really new. But what is new is that the law says that in any event, no matter what happens within the agency for interagency routing and the like, that time starts running no later than 10 days after the request is first received by any component of an agency, any location within an agency that is specified in its regulations as appropriate to receive FOIA requests. So that can help requests getting into the process and getting that clock starting to run more quickly. Now it does, the amendments do add a new element. The new element is it allows an agency to toll that time limit, basically stop those 20 days from running if the agency sends a request to the requester, an informational inquiry, if you will, seeking some information. It might be clarification on the nature of the request, or it might be a letter with respect to fees, and to just verify what the requester's position is regarding fees. It's not entirely clear under the statute exactly how that will go, because one part of it talks about a single letter, and then at the end the bill talks about the response by the requester to different types of requests from the agency. I think very arguably the agency gets only one letter going out. I think I should warn you that you can expect agencies to perhaps take the position that they're entitled to send multiple letters out to toll this time limit multiple times, perhaps even multiply with respect to the fee element. But that's something that I think will have to be litigated, because the way Congress wrote this, it's not entirely clear. Finally, exemption specification. This is just one little additional thing. Those of you who are really into the FOIA, you know that in 1996, Congress said that if agencies, when they respond to requests and delete records, they should, especially in whole part, in other words, many, many pages here or an entire file there, they should give a volume estimation. They should say, okay, we're withholding under Exemption 7A everything responsive to your request, but it consists of, let's say, 200 pages or 3,000 pages or six litigation boxes, some sort of reasonable estimation. Well, now agencies have an obligation like that to also specify exactly which exemptions are being invoked. They've never had to do that before. It's good practice, but a lot of agencies have not done that consistently, and they're obligated to do that right there next to what's being withheld if a record is produced in expurgated form or if it's an electronic form, some reasonable application of that, and that's something relatively new. So that's just a quick overview to try to help you get a good feel for what these amendments do. And I've ended this with some initial questions that hopefully will spur some dialogue. This is not an exhaustive list. This is just some things to get you thinking as we move into our panels this morning. So, with that introduction, I'm going to ask our first three panelists to come up. And as they come up, I'm going to introduce them to you. This is a panel that will focus almost entirely, but not entirely, on the new Office of Government Information Services at the National Security Archive. And we're very pleased to have with us the General Counsel of the National Archives and Records Administration, Gary Stern. Gary is someone who has been with the archives for many, many years now, and prior to that, he worked in the FOIA area at the Department of Energy. And prior to that, when I first met Gary almost 15 years ago, he was with the ACLU. We had a FOIA community conference at the Department of Justice, and Gary was there representing the ACLU. So Gary has a varied experience on both sides of the fence, so to speak. And to Gary's left is Rick Bloom, who also has been working in this area for quite some time. Rick is the director of the Sunshine in Government Initiative, which has been created now for about 2 years. Does that sound right? But prior to that, Rick spent a lot of years working in the FOIA area and pressing for FOIA reform and openness in government at OMB Watch. Do I have that right?
And open the government.
And open the government.org. That's right. I shouldn't have skipped that. And Meredith Fuchs, last but not least, is General Counsel of the National Security Archive, singular. And Meredith has been General Counsel there for now, it seems like, quite a long time, many, many years, yes. And prior to that, she was a partner in a law firm here in D.C., decided that she did not like making a lot of money. She'd rather serve the public interest. And prior to that, she was a law clerk to Chief Judge Patricia Wald, who did issue many FOIA decisions in her time. So I'm going to turn this over now to these folks in this panel, but I'm going to start them off because we don't want so much to put Gary on the hot seat here, because I know what it's like to be a government official and to be able to say what you can say and not say what you can't say. But I want to throw it out to start to Rick and to Meredith. What the heck did you guys have in mind when you proposed this idea of an Office of Government Information Services at NARA and induced Congress to enact it so that it's now suddenly upon us as law?
Well, maybe I can take a crack at that. And let me explain. The Sunshine in Government Initiative is a coalition of 10 media organizations. And we've been very interested in making FOIA improvements for quite a while. And what I'm hoping is I can explain a little bit about what we were thinking about the Ombudsman. We were hoping to make a couple changes. if Congress were to pass legislation here. One is to just simply improve the FOIA process. A lot of people out there, outside of Washington, who aren't privy to the ins and outs of the Freedom of Information Act, are frustrated with the way the system works. You know, when a news organization sues because it takes many, many months or years to get, you know, a fundamental database about, say, VA benefits, and when veterans are, you know, dying, waiting just to hear about their benefits, and then, you know, that's not working. And then they sue, and then they spend over $100,000 in the case of the Associated Press, and then they can't recover their attorney fees. There's just a lot of frustration with the way the system works. So one idea that we came up with is let's have somebody outside of the Justice Department try to mediate disputes. You know, let's help the average requester who's probably not going to sue, can't afford to sue, and let's try to work on building some capacity for the government to figure out what's wrong with the system, what are agencies doing right, what are they not doing well, and what are the specific problems and issues here. And so one of the solutions was, let's have people outside of DOJ look at this and help advocate requesters. We don't want to get rid of the access to the court for requesters if they can sue. And so that's why, can't hear? Are we having trouble hearing?
Yeah,
oh.
But you definitely clicked on to green.
It's green. So
then
how are we doing here?
Pull that up a little higher.
All right. So we want to help FOIA requesters.
How about that? Okay.
I'll work on this. And also help agencies over time make faster decisions and make better decisions so that you don't have to appeal every time once you get a bad denial. And so that there's better training and so that sort of learning of the whole system is improving. We looked at various approaches. When we were thinking about this, we thought about, I think in the original bill, the Administrative Conference of the United States would sort of run this system. That doesn't have any money, so there's no real people, there's no real office there. We looked at inspectors general to look at specific agency issues and agency problems. But we realized how smart Gary is and his colleagues at the National Archives, and we were very attracted to them trying to figure out these problems.
That's one of the good things about programs like this. The people outside of the government community can bond with those inside the government.
Oh, yeah.
Over comments exactly like that and work more effectively in the future.
So I think for us is we just wanted to have an outside independent voice looking at these problems, helping the average requester, the small newspaper that's trying to get some information but is never going to sue, figure out, okay, is my problem that my request is sitting in the queue and the FOIA officer hasn't gotten to it because they just have a four-year backlog? Or is it because I haven't asked for the right thing? What are the issues here, and can we help speed up some of these small requests, but also help the whole process work more effectively? And I'm sure we'll get into talking about what we think Gary should be doing and what he's done over the last 16 days. But that's at least what we think, you know, why the ombudsman we're hoping can be very effective.
I guess I would just add, my organization, National Security Archive, is a very prolific FOIA requester. We make hundreds and hundreds of FOIA requests a year, and we primarily make them to a small group of agencies, the intelligence agencies, the State Department, and the Department of Defense, and NARA, frankly. And so we have experiences and relationships with those agencies, but we hadn't really gone very far beyond that grouping of agencies. Until about 6 years ago, we started doing a series of audits of federal agencies to try to find out how they were processing FOIA. And these now six NITE open government surveys led us to find that there were significant problems in FOIA agencies, in agencies with processing FOIAs. And while we at the National Security Archive have lawyers and staff and are able to address those problems ourselves, the average FOIA requester probably couldn't. I mean, it's one thing to sort of pick, you know, media companies who at least probably have lawyers to advise them, but there's a lot of professors, historians out there. There's a lot of ordinary people who have no one to advise them. And we weren't in a position to take all of those cases. So we definitely felt like, you know, this system is not working. the FOIA system is a black hole at some agencies, and improvements are necessary. And that led to us developing a list of things that we thought were improvements. And right around the same time, as it happened, Senator Cornyn entered the Senate from Texas. And he had actually campaigned in part on open government and had a long commitment to open government and to, you know, I think establishing that an open and accountable government is going to be a good government. He campaigned on that issue, came to the Senate, and pretty early in his term, he asked his counsel to start talking to people and find out about what changes were needed. And from the very beginning, this idea that the mediation service for ordinary FOIA requesters who couldn't sue would be a good idea. You know, frankly, my organization doesn't depend on attorneys' fees to bring our lawsuits. We try to bring cases that we care about because they're going to help FOIA generally, the FOIA community, the open government community. But my understanding from talking to private lawyers is that if, you know, your average Joe on the street wanted to hire someone to bring a FOIA case, it would cost them $10,000, $15,000 even to get started. That's obviously not a good situation. So mediation seemed like a good idea. We spent a lot of time thinking about what would be options. And while I'm sure Gary's not going to be open to saying it, I don't think NARA necessarily would have felt that it was the best fit. NARA engages in large-scale, systematic release of information. FOIA is individual requests, individual disputes. But NARA has the perspective of wanting to make sure that the documentary history of the country is retained and made available to the public. Now, why wouldn't we have just gone with the Department of Justice as a place for this office? The Office of Information Privacy at the Department of Justice has for many years done remarkable work in terms of analyzing FOIA issues, making policy recommendations to agencies. The problem is, it's in the Department of Justice. Well, you know, who do you think defends the agencies when we sue them? The Department of Justice. So from our perspective, there was an inherent conflict there. Despite the expertise, they were not the right people to be giving guidance policy-wise or mediating disputes. And, I mean, we'll talk a little further about what the opportunities here are with the Office of Government Information Services, but I would say one of the biggest opportunities and the way that it could be transformative is to actually give policy guidance, independent guidance, not something that is affected by the fact that the Justice Department will one day have to litigate the issue, but guidance that is going to try to make the FOIA system do what it's supposed to do, which is allow the public to learn what its government's doing.
Gary, with those five functions in the law, and the law being in effect, and I don't want to put you on the spot because I know what it's like to be exactly in that position. I know the phrase unfunded mandate is ringing in your ears. What do you see for the immediate future and then maybe longer range as well?
Well, Dan, you're right. I wish I could tell you everything. And it's been 16 days, and I can report that there is yet no OGIS in the National Archives. And notwithstanding that the law says it shall be effective immediately. And as I warned Dan, I unfortunately will have to be fairly brief in what I can say, because it's just come upon us in NARA and the government, this new law. And so we're waiting, essentially, as the administration deliberates on how to implement this and how to make it work. Obviously, in our FY 2008 budget, there's no money. The budget was passed about the same day as this law was passed, and so we're really not in a position to do anything right at this moment, except to listen. And so I still wanted to come and be part of this, really, to hear from these guys and anybody else, because it's a new concept, it's a new idea. This something like an ombuds office person, certainly for in the federal government. I understand there's, you know, several states have something like this, even some foreign governments do, and so there'll be a learning process for the government to figure out how to implement something like this and make it work. And obviously there is various aspects, not just the mediation point, but some of these policy review and recommendation pieces. And then Dan has raised a very useful question, an important question, which is how does it intersect with OIP, the Office of Information and Privacy, and DOJ? And that's the kind of thing that I think is under review and deliberation to figure out how to make this thing work. So unfortunately, I can't say much more, but I'm here to sort of really to listen and absorb. Not only am I general counsel to the National Archives, I am also the chief FOIA officer. I have been for the last 2 years under the executive order, and now that's, as Dan noted, that's been codified. And so I'm also interested in the various other aspects of this law in terms of how NARA implements FOIA. We implement it in sort of two distinct ways, because as Meredith noted, we of course are the National Archives. We have archival records, the permanent historical records of the United States government, the vast majority of which we open and make available outside of FOIA. We precede FOIA by 30 years. We've been making records public and available since the 1930s. And so have never felt like we needed FOIA to do our job. Of course, it sort of facilitates in some aspects for individuals to get into particular types of records that are otherwise closed, and obviously gives them rights under FOIA in terms of appeal and litigation and such. But we also are an agency, like the many hundreds of other agencies, and we have our own agency records, my records as counsel, and the archivist records, and our contractor records, and personnel records, and all that. And for that, we're like any other agency, and have to deal with those types of FOIAs. And so there's various, all the other provisions in this law will impact us. And of course, we do get sued on occasion, not only under FOIA, as Meredith knows, but in fact, we have a couple pending FOIA cases right now, which are really Open America cases, because unfortunately, particularly at our presidential libraries, we have lots of interesting records, very few archivists to deal with them, and then some great demand. You can imagine, like at the Clinton Library, we have several outstanding requests for records relating to very publicly known figures. So, and we have two lawsuits pending on them right now, in which they're way back in our line, and people want those records out today or tomorrow or for the next primary. And so we're struggling with those things, being sued. Of course, we'll be concerned if they prevail, we have to pay attorney's fees, which the Justice Department always was able to pay for us until now. But anyways, that's that's our perspective. We very much want to hear what other folks. I've already been taking notes about what you guys said, and want to get other perspective on how to make something like this work once the administration figures out how to implement it.
For the benefit of the audience, we knew very much that Gary would be largely in a listening mode today. Although the law took effect 16 days ago as a practical matter, it's still early in the process. And that's not a comment on the government in general. That's just a practical observation. But Gary is able to gather information here today, such as Meredith's suggestion already regarding issues of guidance, FOIA, which might be a controversial one, and also to have a dialogue with people in the audience as to what you think this new office should be oriented toward and should make a priority on as soon as it gets moving in this area. So you have an opportunity to give him input. And today, somewhat uniquely, you have a double opportunity in the sense that after this first panel, Gary is going to be racing downtown to the parallel program that starts in a few minutes, being put on by my old office at the Department of Justice for government-wide chief FOIA officers to talk about the provisions. And Gary will be taking these nice handouts and all the information that we fill his mind with. And if he makes it there by the time that program ends at noon, we'll be able to give some input there as well. So when you raise a question or make a suggestion, or Meredith nudges Gary in a certain direction, he's listening, he's filling his mind with that, and he's also going to be taking that immediately down to ground zero at the Department of Justice. It's the Department of Commerce Auditorium, where I used to hold my programs when I was there, for all the chief FOIA officers government-wide. But with that general comment having been made, let me ask you something specific. And some people in the audience might be familiar with the government budget process, some not. You say that the 2008 budget money, that's already been passed by Congress, right? That's fiscal year 2008. What about fiscal year 2009? Where does that stand in the budget process? Is that something that is set already, or does NARA have to scramble to try to get money into that because Congress is going to start holding appropriations hearings on that budget very, very soon?
Well, you know, the President submits the his proposed budget for the next fiscal year in February, in early February. And so so that's has yet to come out, but will be coming out, I believe, in about 3 weeks, February 4th or 5th, is when the President's budget is submitted on behalf of the entire government for the year starting in October. So, you know, that will be an important time to look at and review what the President is proposing on all these matters.
I think the timetable is, just to bring everyone up to the speed, is that agencies make proposals starting in the spring. They work through a process into the summer and early fall, and then OMB gives what's called a pass back, usually the day after Thanksgiving.
That's right.
A nice way of celebrating that holiday weekend. And then agencies scramble with OMB. They make appeals to get more into the budget that then ultimately leads to what Gary is talking about, February 1. Or sometime in February. Now the question is, and Gary's not going to be able to give you an answer today, but the question is, under these circumstances, will the archives have a mechanism, will they have a way of possibly cracking that process and trying to get some funding in the 2009 fiscal year budget, or is that completely set in stone that the only way that the archive can make this less than an unfunded mandate is to try to steal from Peter to feed Paul within existing constraints? This sounds a little bit geeky, I realize, with respect to budgetary matters, but it really does make a difference in this case, doesn't it, Gary?
Absolutely.
So you're really not sure about how that'll go?
Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see what comes out.
Okay. But if members of the openness and government community wanted to apply pressure, theoretically, on the administration with respect to the operation of this office sooner rather than later, that's something that people would have to have in mind, the mechanics of that budget process. Meredith, what do you think? Do you see organizations like yours and others mindful of the mechanics there, perhaps applying that type of pressure?
Calling this new office OGIS, so I'm going to use that shorthand today, what OGIS needs to have any impact. And the top of my list is it needs money. And so to the extent that we are in a position to try to help OGIS get money, we would make those efforts. You know, the Office of Information and Privacy, the Justice Department has a fairly large staff of attorney experts. You know, OGIS obviously is going to need to have a staff of attorney experts in order to do its job. So that would be, you know, top of my list. I would say that if OGIS has money, there's a lot they can do to have an impact, and I think that they can draw lessons from what's happening in other countries and in the United States, because, frankly, the U.S. is somewhat behind the ball on this idea. In many other countries, they have information commissioners or commissions that are funded independent bodies or offices that have authority to actually order records to be released. We have nothing like that in the United States. It's, you know, the public against the government. It shouldn't really be that way, frankly, right? Since the government is our government, but it is. So we're a little bit behind the ball, and what we've done by creating OGIS is a step forward, but it's not a huge step forward, especially if there's no money. What could OGIS do to be effective? Well, what are folks doing in these other places? Some of these offices publish their decisions, publish their advice and policy so that members of the public can see it, so Congress could see it, so that agencies could all see it. It makes a difference to see it in writing in front of everyone. They could make policy recommendations and conduct training. I'm very concerned that the issue between OCHIS and the Office of Information Privacy may result in no difference in terms of who is issuing policy guidance to the government. And as I said before, I just think there's an inherent conflict. It's not meant to disparage people in OIP. I think that they've done a lot of great work and made very good recommendations. I think that the president could issue some sort of statement of support for this office and could let the agencies know that they are expected to participate in mediation with OGIS and are expected to pay attention to the recommendations of that office. And of course, Congress can support as well, both by conducting hearings, listening to what OGIS says, and also, you know, passing a funding bill for OGIS. I think that this office should report to Congress because Congress created it and should let Congress know if it needs more. And ultimately, I mean, it would be ideal if the agencies had some sort of legal duty to actually consult with OGIS on these difficult cases rather than simply fighting against the public. I would rather the government's money be spent on trying to work these things out and coming out with solutions instead of litigating against all the FOIA customers out there.
Rick, picking up on Meredith's point about the president perhaps issuing some sort of memorandum and perhaps downscaling it to what might be more realistic, more practical, do you think that there might be any feeling within public interest groups that a logical step would be to ask new Attorney General Mukasey to take such a step as to issue that sort of a statement, perhaps accompany that with an offer to NARA of several slots, perhaps, or FTEs in common personnel parlance that would ease the pain a little bit, and perhaps even try to do that before he appears before Congress for his next big hearing on January 30th. Do you think that's a realistic prospect?
Getting all that done in 2 weeks?
Well, that might be hard, yes.
Sure, that would get done in 2 weeks, but, you know, look, any support that this office can have would be welcome, and I think really helpful.
This is no easy task. They've got a lot to do, and they don't have a lot of time to get it up and running. And so they're going to need a lot of support from Congress.
And frankly, from all of us who want to see the FOIA process work better. You know, I think that they, in addition to just getting money and people in the office, they need to have a strategy to start small and work up. You know, don't take every request for mediation that comes in and create the huge backlog at NARA. Well, you know, we don't want that. Pick and choose a few that are going to have significant impact.
You know, report your progress publicly so that you're building support. You're basically helping future requesters. You're helping the public understand the process better. And, you know, strategically, pick and choose your battles when you're trying to report on what agencies are doing. The Government Accountability Office has some reporting that they have to do as well as they have to do. But, you know, pick and choose agencies, describe some of the problems that they're having, and what are some solutions?
You know, I think there's so much frustration out there with the way the FOIA process works and a lack of understanding of what the real problems are and why things don't move faster. And, you know, why aren't we putting more information online? I just think that starting small and starting strategically and showing some success early on and some impact will greatly help this office's chances of succeeding. I mean, this is not...
some of the work that Lauren, you were doing and looking at the ombudsman and others in the states show that really the most effective ombudsmen are people who are just standing up there developing their reputation for knowledge and for expertise and are fair and relatively impartial. And that those are the most effective people, or ombudsmen. You know, I think that's a very important
lesson for the federal ombudsman.
Gary, without you necessarily committing or even implying that NARA will do anything in particular, because you're still in that listening mode. Do you think that you and NARA and OGIS incipiently would find it useful if you received information from public interest groups, from NGOs interested in the implementation of those new responsibilities that described for you mediation functions, perhaps best practice mediation functions that are used elsewhere at the state level, and I'm thinking of Connecticut and New York, and also worldwide, and I'm thinking of Canada in particular, and I'm sure Meredith can add a few more to that, where you had a good working document that educated NARA as a starting point for what would be good things to do, or best things to do, so to speak. Would that be useful?
It's right here. Five articles, I promised Gary, that I was going to bring today that are about international ombuds offices and state ombuds offices and state mediation services. I called and asked if they would like to see some of the scholarship on the issue, and Gary said absolutely.
Absolutely, and that's part of listening is welcoming and looking and reviewing, and so Meredith did call me yesterday, and I said, absolutely, we'd like to see anything she's collected. And so we arranged for her to bring it today. I believe some of you know there's an effort in a proposed conference coming up in February by Tom Sussman, who is helping to organize. He didn't plug it in his Gene Weingarten article, but he... in late February, and that'll be an opportunity, and I think he's planning to bring in folks, actual commissioners and such from states and even around the world to talk about this, how they've done this as a way of giving input, and so we certainly welcome the input, and we'll be looking and then trying to figure it out.
That was not a trick question. I know Meredith is very efficient, but I didn't know offhand that she had already brought that information
to
you. Okay. How about questions from the audience at this point? Or not just questions or even input, so to speak, to Gary as he struggles with this obligation, this unfunded mandate, and then tries to get things up and running as quickly, as effectively as possible. This is an opportunity for people to, you can come up to the mic, or if the acoustics are good enough, even shout it out. Depending on, I think we're podcasting, if not webcasting, this program, so it's probably better for people to come up to the mic for that. Bill, you're in the, you want to come to the mic as well? Okay. Kevin, yes.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have used relatively. I don't want to read too much into what I'm saying here, but, the public wants someone they can go to fix the problems. They want the documents. They want the information because they're not worried about openness in government. They're worried about if their safety of their kids is in jeopardy because there's chemicals in the school drinking water. They want to get this stuff quickly. And, there was a report 20 years ago that looked at the DOJ's, our ombudsman, informal ombudsman function where people could call up and say they have a problem. And then, Dan's office would do what it could, make a phone call or two and help smooth things along. And that was great. But this report said, much like today, not too many people know about it. Given the enormity of the problems, it could use some more publicity, and more people would make use of it. In other words, there's a wide range of demand out there for some arbitration, and OIP, hasn't been able to strengthen this function to meet that demand.
That was 20 years ago, and the same is true today. And as Meredith said, I think that the OIP's function has been to help agencies understand the FOIA operations and train them and get them up to speed on what their obligations and responsibilities really are. We saw another function, very separate. You got to have some independent voice out there who's really helping the requester. And that you don't have in the system. You go to the agency, if you get a denial of your request, you can appeal to the agency. Some agencies do a good job of looking new at your request and the documents in the denial and saying, oh, well, this was right or this was wrong, and we really should have released. You know, it's proper that we didn't release. Some agencies, you're just talking to the same people when you say, no, look at this again. So, you know, what we wanted was something short of going and hiring a lawyer and spending tens of thousands of dollars to try to figure something out and to mediate those disputes. So,
I think Rick makes a very good point. I mean, part of what we're going for here is to reduce the adversarialness so that ordinary FOIA requesters don't feel like their government's the enemy, and they actually feel like they can try to get the information they want and need to protect their families and their communities, which, frankly, is what the vast majority of people care about and, you know, have a right to. So that's a huge driver behind a mediation service. I will say that, you know, in order to be effective, whoever heads up this office is going to have some standing with the agencies and with the public. I think a good example of a model, although it's very different to follow, would be something like the Information Security Oversight Office, which has typically been headed by someone who has significant experience in, from the government perspective. But once they broke free from their, you know, original agency and were able to kind of think about not just their client agency, but their client, the American public, they were able to, that office has been able to have a big impact on classification issues. Another thing that I would urge Gary and Nara to think about is something like what the Public Interest Declassification Board has done, where they had hearings, they went and they spoke with all the agencies, they heard what they had to say about classification issues, they had hearings where they heard from members of the public and from organizations, and they just issued a report last week for people interested in classification. I recommend you read it. It had a lot of really useful recommendations. Now, of course, same problem OGIS is going to have. How do you go from great ideas to implementation? And that's the next thing that we all need to think about. But what struck me about that report was, you know, I come at this as an advocate, openness advocate, and I don't necessarily know or weigh all the concerns. I weigh our concerns. I mean, I don't know everything that a government person might know. But that PIDB report, I thought the recommendations showed a great consciousness of all the perspectives. And I think that's the kind of thing that OGIS can do. They can really take into account the government needs concerns, legitimate concerns, and the public's legitimate needs and concerns.
Meredith just gave the real answer. They've done such a great job on some of these other things that I think that they're the perfect fit for this.
Rick, do you and Meredith have an idea, just a conception, as people who have advocated this new program, this new office at NARA, and the mediation service function in particular, do you have an idea as to how many mediations, quote unquote, an office like this will have per year once it's up and running? Has anyone, and be careful about what number you articulate there, because Gary will get a little frightened perhaps. But do you see this as an office that will have 100 mediations a year, 1,000, some order of magnitude?
I think if it's, I don't have a number. I think that if it's, you could easily get it overwhelmed by every request for mediation services. If it's marketed right, you probably get a lot. How many you will take on, I don't know, but you would want to take on, I would hope, those that will have an impact on future requests and have an impact on future agency decisions. You know, the Office of Government Ethics kind of oversees the conflict of interest rules and laws for the federal government. They post every advisory committee, or every advisory opinion, excuse me, that they have. They get letters from agencies saying, well, we have this situation. how do we interpret the rules? What should we do? And so they give a response, and then they redact in the name of the agency's, you know, specific information about the circumstance. But they post it so that you can see what their thinking is and how they interpret the laws and regulations. And then they use those and refer back to them. So they're creating a precedent. So they're creating learning so that you're improving the system and the public has a better understanding of that. I would hope that in these mediation services, you would include, you know, posting these advisory committee, advisory opinions and creating this kind of building the precedent. You know, frankly, I think the biggest impact that this may have, this office may have, is just providing a single phone number or a single place for people who care about FOIA and have questions about their requests outside of the agencies, a single place for them to go, whether it's, you know, staffers in Congress or the public, media, whomever, and really figure out what's going on.
Rick, before Meredith has an opportunity to give a suggested estimate number or not, you used a phrase a moment ago that really raises the question, perhaps, of statutory interpretation. This is a law school, and we worry about things like that, to be sure. We take an academic and a legal academic approach. You said you're not sure about how many mediations that NARA will take on. And that makes me remember that the statutory language says that NARA, through OGIS, shall offer, quote unquote, mediation services.
Yes.
Are you implying that NARA, as a matter of law, would have the discretion to not take on every request for mediation that comes in?
Well, the statute doesn't say it shall take on every request for mediation. So, you know, I think it's just as a matter of limited budget, they're going to have to make some choices and decisions. And what you don't want is to create another backlog so that you go to the agency, you wait 4 years, then they finally get your request, it gets to the top of the pile. They give you a decision that you don't like, and then you go, well, I want mediation. So now I've got to wait another 3 years before, you know, I get a new tracking number before they'll look at my appeal. We don't want that.
So you're suggesting that the words shall offer might be interpreted by NARA, theoretically, to mean offer in general, but not make available in every particular case.
We want, I think that, you know, the most important thing is to be effective at whatever it takes on. And if it takes on a smaller portion of what people might want in the ideal world, but is good at it and is making an impact on the way agencies are operating their FOIA, that's great, and we can build on it. And we can find out through their public reports about what they feel like they're supposed to be doing that they can't do.
See, I could see Gary's ears perk up when
yeah.
he suggested that, and his eyebrows raised, as it's possible that perhaps not every request for mediation will go through their process necessarily. And I'm thinking, quite frankly, of a lot of FOIA requesters from the other side of prison walls who make FOIA requests for all sorts of things, litigate quite heavily, and also might be a very large part of Gary's clientele. I'm not saying that we should discriminate against them necessarily, but that's just one example of a category of FOIA requester that Gary might not, to use your phrase, take on, or at least not take on automatically in all cases.
Now, let me also jump in and say, I'm not guaranteeing that we're going to be happy with this result. We may, you know.
So Gary stopped writing.
I know.
And then, of course, you're going to want to appeal, right? And so we have to have an appeal mechanism on mediation.
Well, I think, just realistically, this office is going to have to show that it can do something and be effective at it. And we think the archives is the best place to show some effectiveness. But, you know, we're still going to be here. And there will always be FOIA issues and problems and obstacles. And we intend to try to help make the FOIA system work better.
Meredith, you've had a lot of time now to think about what your estimated number would be and about whether the shall offer should be merely take on, not necessarily all. What view do you have, and what, more importantly, what view do you think most public interest NGO groups would have on that?
I'm actually not going to give a number either. But I'm going to start with these couple of comments. I mean, one of the things we found when we did the Knight Open Government surveys is that a lot of really stupid and really unacceptable mistakes are being made at agencies, okay? And that's part of the reason we felt like people should have someone to talk to other than the same person who's making the stupid and unacceptable mistakes. However, the Office of Government Information Services is not the only thing in this bill. And in fact, it is not the only thing that's happened in the last couple of years of FOIA. As Dan mentioned at the opening, the president issued an executive order on FOIA, which is supposed to improve customer service. This law requires agencies to have tracking numbers, requires them to have a hotline. I mean, just being able to find out that your FOIA request is not lost is a huge advance. And it may be that the Justice Department takes the perspective that this is not a change, but I will tell you, based on meeting with people from agencies, that there are some agencies that throw out FOIA requests that they can't process. There are plenty of agencies that lose them, that don't log them in. This is not a nothing change. It matters. So in theory, if some of the other things in this statute work, then OGIS is not going to have to deal with a FOIA requester who says, I need mediation because I called Department X, and they can't even tell me if they have my FOIA request. So I would hope that some of those things are going to be fixed by other things, and then OGIS is going to be able to focus on, you know, the real persistent issues that may require a little bit of independent analysis.
But OGIS will have a statutory mandate to review agency compliance with the law. So would you see it playing a role in that respect as well, not just regarding mediation?
Well, I certainly hope they would play a role in that respect. But I think, you know, as Gary is alluding to, these are issues that are going to take a little bit of working out within the government. I mean, we would certainly advocate for OGIS having more responsibility and having the staff to perform those responsibilities.
Okay. We have an audience question here.
Yes. My name is Joan Margrath, and I'm a FOIA case processor at the Department of State. And I want to say I'm very passionate about all my cases. I work as hard and as fast as I can. I think about them even on the weekends, about which requesters and how old are the cases. And my question is what is being done to help promote that there are more full-time positions to help us? I would love to have more colleagues at all of the agencies. And I think this is a big problem. So there are people working their hearts out for FOIA, and we can't get things done as fast as we'd like because of the large volume. So we'd like some more help.
Well, there is a principal answer to your question, which is Section 11 of the bill. It's not to be codified as part of the structure of the FOIA itself. You'll see it at the very end of the Ramsayer copy that we have in the bottom of your package. But that does require OPM by December 31st of this year to submit a report that focuses on just that sort of thing. And I would dare say that OPM should be getting input not just from each agency officially, but perhaps should be allowing input from individual agency FOIA officers. So I would encourage agency FOIA officers, perhaps even through organizations such as the American Society of Access Professionals, of which Meredith is an officer, to have heavy input to OPM in implementation of that provision. That's really your best bet government-wide for the time being.
I just want to add a quick comment on that, because that provision comes in part out of something my organization really was advocating for. I just want to also mention the State Department, despite being exceedingly slow, is one of the agencies we think takes this very seriously and really makes an effort to release information that's releasable and has a very good appeal process, which is part of the reason it takes them a long time. However, we have for a long time felt like at some agencies the FOIA personnel are treated like the least important personnel at the agency, and we think that it is important that they be treated with respect, they be given the training they need and the resources they need. And so that's kind of what's behind this provision. And I would also note that some agencies in their FOIA improvement plans that resulted from the President's executive order made a point of doing this on their own without the statute, including, I know DOD began a process to look at its FOIA grade, the grades for FOIA positions and the like, and we completely support efforts like that. I mean, it should be the people who are doing these jobs at FOIA agencies, you know, are the kind of gatekeepers to all the information about what the government's doing and play an important role.
Meredith has always been very supportive of FOIA officers, that's for sure, because she deals with so many of them, largely successfully, not entirely, so regularly. Question on this side, sir.
Mark Zaid, I litigate daily probably against all the agencies through private practice in the James Madison Project. Gary, I feel really bad for you that the archives has had this burden placed on them probably without much ability to say anything, even though from a government standpoint, I agree with Rick, this is the place it best should be. I have no idea how you're going to pull this off from a financial standpoint.
Has anyone asked Gary how close he is to retirement, by the way?
Yeah.
That's a fact question that has not come up, I don't think.
Especially knowing the other budgetary issues that you guys are going under with a declassification process that you're way behind due to all the numbers. This office is going to come down to two things, independence and teeth. And especially not even looking at it from the requester standpoint as far as whether the archives or the office will accept mediation. How about the agency standpoint? There's no requirement in this that the agencies have to listen to this office in the slightest. I'll predict anything right now, the CIA is going to tell you to take a hike. Every time you ask them, will you come and mediate a national security dispute over whether or not these documents should or should not be released?
Mark, we could ask the CIA person in the audience to give a response to that, but either he or she would not identify him or herself.
That's right. In the short term, because I think this is going to take a while for the archives to be able to organize itself due to the finances, what I would suggest is something that we were doing 15 years ago with the Assassination Records Review Board, which was to hold initial meetings with the agency, in that case the board, to help set up what its regulations internally would be, help define terms, help set out the scope of how it would operate. I think one of the things in particular would be, well, what types of mediation cases do we want the office to initially take to be able to actually be functional? For example, I guarantee you most requesters from the public are probably going to call up and say, the agency wouldn't give me documents. Will you please mediate it? And what are you going to do about that? But you could mediate. Well, I asked them to go search these offices, and they're telling me they don't think that that's reasonable. Do you think that this is reasonable? Because why is it that all the time I have to go to litigation to be able to finally persuade the assistant U.S. attorney to tell the agency, you know, you have to go search these agencies. That makes sense. Because otherwise that's what the judge is going to tell you to do anyway. So I wouldn't have had to waste all my time as well as agency budget time with that as well. Now, these are things you can at least do initially, maybe at a cost of providing some coffee and a room at Archives 2 to hold some meetings within. And probably in the nonprofit group, maybe we can even hold jointly these types of meetings as well to even bear some of the costs to help set the stage for how this process would work. Because I don't know, you know, who are you going to place into these positions? Are you going to get detailees from other agencies to come in, or are you going to take them all from the archives? Are you going to try and get budgetary means by which to hire new hirees? I don't envy you.
I'm guessing that there could be a wide range of individuals and groups, litigators and what I've been calling NGOs, public interest groups, who might be sending letters to the archive as well, sooner rather than later, just with polite suggestions as to what they might do. And Gary, I'm imagining, tell me if I'm wrong, that the archive would be receptive to that.
Absolutely. If only we could
pay attention.
If only we could pay for coffee for other government employees. Mark, I think those are some excellent ideas, and that is the kind of thing we'll be looking for, the administration will be looking for in terms of how to make this work. And I mean, he had some, you know, sort of creative outside-the-box ideas, which may be self-evident, because obviously no office, no mediation is going to be able to, you know, get past your basic application of exemptions in most cases in which agencies, you know, can apply exemptions and all. So, but looking at other concepts and other approaches makes good sense.
Next question here.
I share Mark's concern. I'm Grace Mastalli and have just completed 30 years of trying to make federal programs work. And
most recently at the Department of Homeland Security, which was perhaps the greatest challenge.
And I have a concern that the goals of the legislation and the actual legislative drafting of the enacted statute may, at least in the short term, be counterproductive. Several people have noticed, you know, how is this going to be implemented and how many of the provisions are going to be require litigation or policy interpretation. And this is only one of several elephants that we're trying to graft on the back of the NARA flea. When what we're really talking about is trying to legislate, regulate, and organize a cultural transformation of information management and openness in the federal government, where, as Meredith and several others have noted, the lowest step on the totem pole, the lowest activity assigned to the lowest ranking person, is dealing with the avalanche of FOIA requests that get circulated. And when you have a culture, not just in one or two departments, but where the leadership signal is saying, comply, but take it out of hide. One of the things I'm afraid will happen is what Dan alluded to, is that the most knowledgeable people at the Department of Justice and the State Department, the only way Gary's going to have any staff with substantive knowledge, will be transferred. Well, then their backlogs are going to get bigger and longer. We've seen what happened with the layering on of, you know, guidance and coordination offices in the intelligence community and elsewhere. And my greatest fear is that in the short term, this will be counterproductive. And I guess for Meredith and Rick, are your goals looking forward to the change of administration and a leadership transformation? I mean, there are people like the processor from the State Department who literally work untold hours trying to take care of their caseloads when the resources and the leadership and the prioritization, and I don't see NARA or OGIS being able to have a dramatically greater effect on that than OIP did, unless you have the support from OMB and the White House as well as the Congress.
Well, Gary's not in a position yet to speak exactly to how that's going to work and what support he'll get, but I'm sure he would say, and I'll say this on behalf, that NARA will be pressing for as much support as is humanly possible under the circumstances, first in this administration and then in a future administration, no matter who the president, no matter who she or he or he or she might be. Rick?
I would agree that there is a culture change that's needed. And, I mean, you use the word comply. The system's not going to work if agencies and leadership are only going to seek to comply. If they're going to put more effort into proactively getting more information online and just seeing it as a part of the mission of every office and every program to put online things that the people might be interested in, that's going to avoid the FOIA requests. You'll still have to have the quote-unquote librarian who's sitting at the help desk helping the requester go into the stacks, basically, and pull that book that they're interested in. But if the stacks are open, then you're going to reduce the need for this difficult process. We were very sensitive, you know, to the fact that oftentimes the FOIA officers are the biggest advocates within the agency for making the system work. In Texas, you know, Meredith mentioned that Senator Cornyn was very interested in his experience in Texas. You know, in Texas, I think they at least put one government employee in jail for improperly withholding a requested document.
That's only because they have so many jails in Texas.
Maybe. Maybe they're trying to fill them. At the federal level, that doesn't work. You know, that wouldn't work. So how do you create the
penalties and the positive incentives for agencies as a whole to take this on. You know, as a whole, I don't think this legislation was necessarily targeting the FOIA office. It was targeting the agencies, saying, look, if you don't put more attention on this, if you don't make this process work better, you're going to have to pay attorney fees. You want that? You better get on top of this. Our goal wasn't to fund litigation, but it was to make agencies say, wait a minute, FOIA's got to be a higher priority.
Rick, we have someone who's been waiting patiently to ask a question. I can't tell offhand whether she's from a federal agency or not.
I will say.
Pardon me?
I will say.
Will say. And she's not from an intelligence agency, probably.
No, my name is Ariadne Girk, and I'm an attorney with the EPA and have litigated with DOJ and FOIA matters for a decade. And it concerns me that we may squander this opportunity in terms of what is our ultimate goal. It is to get information to people quicker. In my view, the best way to do that is to not only encourage the advocates that exist in agencies, who may be the FOIA officers, who may be attorneys, who may be others, that are very committed to FOIA. And I think the role that this office within NARA, and I personally think it's the perfect place to go because of the understanding of records and information, that really is the basis of how you get information to people pursuant to FOIA. Where are the records? Where is the information? In the absence of knowing that, it's very difficult in the complex requests to realize how you get information to the public. Unfortunately, it does take litigation, and even when it reaches to the level of attorneys being involved within an agency, we even have our own challenges organizationally. And so my recommendation would be to have this new office work to strengthen, and I think the best vehicle through the new statute to do that is the FOIA public liaison. Start with looking where that is placed within an organization. Within the statute, it says it reports to the chief information officer. Well, if you also have your chief FOIA officer, if you also have your FOIA officer in the same organization and the FOIA public liaison, there might be a challenge with having there be potentially that little bit of independence that might be needed to, one, be critical of what that office is doing, and also to be working with an eye on how are we going to make change internal to this agency. And I think that component of what this office could do to strengthen the FOIA public liaison role within agencies would be a very helpful one. I just would hate to see this become just another adversarial process. We're all going to worry about how OIP and OMB and NARA are going to get along. It really should be about how are we going to strengthen what's going to happen within the agencies. And obviously, we know there won't be new money for that. So it's the thinking part of it, not the resource part.
Again, I'm going to speak for Gary, and I know he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure Gary is very interested in establishing a good working relationship with OIP in this process. As a matter of fact, he had an outstanding one to begin with, as evidenced by the fact that I think it was on my last official day at the Justice Department as head of that office in January of 2007, just about a year ago, I had my last meeting with Gary and some people on his staff to try to work on a narrow issue. So there is a long-standing relationship there. It might not be quite the same with the current people who are there because there have been a lot of change in personnel, a lot of people who have left. But so long as Gary doesn't try to steal too many slots or FTEs from OIP, I think you can expect that there'll be a pretty good working relationship as well.
And I appreciate Dan doing most of my talking today, so thank you, Dan.
That's okay. Hey, again, no one more than I knows what it's like to be on the spot like that. In an information policy area where you can say only what you can say and really can't properly say more than that. Yes, sir, you've been very patient with the question there.
My name's Tom Field. I'm on the adjunct faculty here. I have a question for Gary Stern, which...
We may let Gary answer this one directly as well.
Focuses on your initial comments, which indicated very clearly that there's essentially no money this year, no money at present in the NARA budget for implementation of this act. And I reflected on that and came to the fairly quick conclusion that realistically, there is not going to be money in any budget to implement this act until the budget sent forward a year from now for fiscal 2010. And my question basically is, given that fact, what can you do in the interim to assist in implementing this act?
Good question, and
seat's getting hotter.
That's right. That one is exactly what we're trying to figure out, and the administration is trying to figure out right now. And so I really can't offer any more but to sort of wait and see what's figured out and what's determined, and including potentially what the president proposes in the 09 budget.
Hey, can I just say, I don't know if any of you have seen Charlie Wilson's War, very interesting movie, but around the second scene of it, Tom Hanks playing Charlie Wilson finds out there's only $5 million in the budget for Afghanistan, in the black budget, and he says, double it, make it $10 million, and it happens immediately, so we just need someone like that to come to NARA's rescue.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Well, the archivist of the United States, Alan Weinstein, has a lot of clout, has a lot of power, and has a lot of stature because he is indeed a formal FOIA requester. He wrote a book about Alger Hiss called Perjury years ago, and he used the Freedom of Information Act in the late 1970s very effectively, and even thanks the statute in the preface of that book. As an historian, he respects it very much. So it's possible, and Gary, of course, cannot even nod his head to what I'm about to say, but it's possible that Alan Weinstein, as the head of NARA, will even try to get some money into that 2009 budget in advance of the 2010 timetable. It's not easily done because that budget comes out just next month, and again, it's reflective of a process that began way back last spring and came to a head during Thanksgiving weekend. But there have been occasions in the past where, especially when there's a new statutory mandate, agencies have been able to persuade OMB and in turn Congress, which ought to be a player here to be sure, to throw at least a little bit of money, maybe not Charlie Wilson's $5 million in, a little bit of money toward that end. And I will tell you, it's curious that you mentioned, Meredith, the number $5 million. That is exactly the budget of OIP when I retired last year, just about $5 million. I'm not sure Gary needs all of that, but he probably would settle for a good fraction of it, to be sure. We might have time for just one more question, and I know there was a hand up over here. It was from, is there a question? No, okay, there was one earlier. It was from a gentleman who is from an agency that shall remain nameless, but the initials of the NSC, but we'll go back further. Gentleman from an institution that will not remain nameless, from Congress, as a matter of fact. Final question in the back row, sir.
Sure. Matthew Johnson.
It's probably better for purposes, Matt, for the podcast and the webcast, if you can come up to the mic, which I think is now definitely working. Matt will be on our third panel this morning, and we're going to take a break as soon as this panel is completed, and we'll make this the last question.
Maybe by way of introduction, I'm just going to interject that Senator Cornyn and Senator Leahy and Senator Kyle had initial objections in the bill, but then later really worked things out. These are really the folks who are responsible for, you know, pushing this on the Hill and making this happen. But I don't want to take your time.
So Matt is not just from any Hill office, to be sure. Yeah. He's from an office that was ground zero with respect to this entire amendment process.
Thank you. I just wanted to note Meredith's pointing out of the potential conflict of interest, OIP and OGIS, as we're calling it now, and was curious about her take on detailing OIP attorneys to OGIS for the initial setup of it, and whether you saw problems there and why.
You know, that's actually an interesting idea that I hadn't thought about until this panel today. And when whomever originally brought it up, I start to think about the experience of people being detailed. And for instance, I have several acquaintances, friends who are assistant U.S. attorneys who've been detailed to congressional offices or detailed to agencies. And, you know, I imagine and I understand that when you're detailed, then you are responsible to the office you're detailed to. You know, my concerns about OIP have nothing to do with the people. If anything, I think that it's a phenomenal staff. My concern is just that their role is to advise the Justice Department primarily, and they're involved in Justice Department litigation. But take one of those great people and put them in NARA under the supervision of whomever is going to head up OGIS, or perhaps one of them will head up OGIS, and that might transform it significantly. So I think that's an interesting and a good idea.
That's just a perfect example of the type of input and idea that Gary can now take with him down to the government-wide session that began about 45 minutes ago or so, where Gary's going to be working together with my successors over there in OIP to try to tell the rest of the government what to expect in implementation of this law as well. So Gary, I'm sure when he first walks in down there, the first words out of his mouth will be, by the way, OIP, how many people are you going to detail to us? True. But this is a unique opportunity to give input to Gary in his listening mode, and so he can take it right down and have direct infusion of that information right into the government process. That assumes that he can make it downtown before that session ends at noon. So I want to thank everybody on this panel and the questions from the audience. Thank you very much. Gary, in particular, has been very patient and polite and as forthcoming as absolutely possible. What we're going to do is take about a 15-minute break now, and then we'll roll right into panels 2 and 3. We'll be there now.